I think we'll get started again. I'm filling in for my chairman. We'll ask the second panel to come to the table, the Honorable Cecile Hansen, chairwoman, Duwamish Tribe, Seattle, Washington, the Honorable Ray Gardner, chairman, Chinook Nation, Raymond, Washington, the Honorable Curtis P. Chambers, tribal chairman, Burt Lake, Band of Ottawa and Chippewa from my great state of Michigan, Mr. John Sinclair, Little Soul Tribe of Chippewa, Indians of Montana, Fawn Sharp, President of Quinault Indian Nation, Tohola, Washington, John Daniels, Jr., Vice Chair, Muckleshoot Tribal Council, Auburn, Washington. I think we'll probably proceed in that order in which we called your names, and you may begin. We'll hear from all of you first and then have questions. And I appreciate your attendance. You're here to defend the retention of your sovereignty. Madam Chair. Yes, it is, right. Is the mic on? Could you pull the mic a little closer, please? Okay.
Anyway, good afternoon, and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Cecile Hansen, and I am the great-great-niece of Chief Sealth, known to you as Chief Seattle. I am also descendant of Chief Seattle's brother. My grandmother, Jane Garrison, who lived to be 114 years old. She survived by gathering clams and eating them. So there must be something said about eating clams. My mother survived the indignities of the Indian boarding school. And I have been the chair of the Duwamish tribe and have served in this capacity for 34 years. And I was asked to start serving because of my brother, Manny Oliver, who is now deceased, but who was fighting for fishing rights in the Duwamish River. And so because of him, I am now serving on behalf of our people. I am now considered an elder, and I would like to see justice for my people in my lifetime. And on behalf of the Duwamish tribe, I'd like to thank you for inviting us to testify on behalf of HR 2678. I also want to express my appreciation to Congressman Representative Jim McDermott for sponsoring this very important bill, a bill that promises to bring justice to Seattle's First People. Since time immemorial, the Duwamish tribe has called Elliott Bay their home. Today, the gratitude of the early settlers lives on their direct descendants who actively supported the Duwamish tribe, including their struggle to restore our federal recognition. When Isaac Stevens arrived in Puget Sound in 1850, he was well aware that the Duwamish was the dominant tribe, both economically and politically, with extension relationships with the tribes throughout the Puget Sound, but the entire Northwest Territory. Chief Seoth, on behalf of the Duwamish and Suquamish tribe, and an additional three Duwamish chiefs and leaders were among the leaders of the treaty, today known as the Treaty of the Point Elliott. The Point Elliott Treaty was ratified by Congress on March 8, 1859. However, the presidential order established the boundaries of the general reservation described in the treaty was not issued until December 23, 1873, about 19 years after the treaty was signed. As times passed, the initial gratitude to Seattle first European settlers gave way to outright racial animosity against the Duwamish and called for the removal from the Seattle area. The city of Seattle responded on February the 7th, 1865, enacting Ordinance 5, an ordinance for the removal of Indians which banned all Indians, including resident Duwamish, from city limits. In 1893, the non-Indians set fire to the Duwamish houses in West Seattle along the banks of the Duwamish River. Yet, the other attempt to drive out the very tribe where generosity and sacrifice had helped their community to thrive. 2008, we built a longhouse, first time since 1894, with the help of Bill Gates, Paul Allen, and the descendants of the original pioneers of Seattle. Without these people in deep pockets and the communities of Seattle supporting us, we would not be able to build our first home since they burned down all the longhouses. So for that, we're very, very grateful. The Duwamish was included in a list prepared by the Department of the Interior in 1950 inclusion in the congressional report named Tribes in the Washington State, recommended by the Department for Termination of Federal Trust Relationship. The inclusion on this list begs the obvious question. The United States must have considered a Duwamish a tribe. Otherwise, there would never have been the need to terminate us. The Duwamish tribe initially petitioned for federal acknowledgement in 1977, the year prior to the Department of Interior publishing the regulations governing the procedures for recognition of tribes. In response to the regulations, the Duwamish submitted a documented petition in 1987. It seems to me that having been involved in this process since that time, and then we finally we got a negative in 1996, and I was appalled, I was devastated, I cried because it was negative. However, the determination of our people said we're going to fight on. And I always say when I'm speaking to any of the non-Indian people, I say to them, why do Indians have to fight for the right to be recognized? Excuse me for a minute. It is clear to the Duwamish that the decision to recognize or not recognize their tribe depends upon the administration controlling the decision-making of the department rather than the objective consideration of the merits of our petition. We trust this committee respects better from the department. Our experience with the department recognition process is perhaps the most glaring example how broken the process really is. I was asked to come back and represent about six tribes in the state of Washington, and I testified on behalf of them that this process does not work on behalf of Indian tribes who seek to be acknowledged. When it comes to the department recognition process, three things are certain. Each year, the Congress conducts hearings in which all agree that the department recognition is broken. Every year, the department officials argue that the department will soon fix the very problems with the recognition process. And every year, nothing changes, leaving tribes to continue to suffer. The Duwamish tribe has been the victim of the department's broken recognition process for the past 32 years. With the broken system languishing year after year, our people continue to be denied the fundamental services provided to serve to our tribes and the Duwamish tribe deprived of its right to be on equal footing with other tribes that signed the Point Elliott Treaty. H.R. 2678 promises to finally release the Duwamish from the yoke of the department's broken recognition process and would allow us to take our rightful place among this fellow signature tribes to the Treaty of Point Elliott. The Duwamish tribe respectfully urges you to reaffirm our federal recognized status by acting favorably on H.R. 2678. That may be one step closer to finally realizing justice. Finally, it is worth repeating the words of a Duwamish chief, Satayakam, who recorded on the 16th of April, 1915, which was true 94 years later. I will forget the lies that the government has told us many times. If only the government will settle with younger members of our tribe. Give us land, we want fish, and we want game. Governor Stevens told us that the white man was honest. Now let the white man government prove it. The image that you've been seeing on thing is our future generations and our elders, and that's why it's so important because of these kids and our elders that you support H.R. 2678. And I heard the Department of Interior testify that, you know, there's a lawsuit pending or something to the effect, but you know in the regulations you have the right to appeal this kind of a decision. And I just want to thank you, you and the chairman of the committee, for this opportunity to testify. And I can't apologize for the emotional, because I have been trying to do this for over 30 years. And I care very deeply. And because of the memory of my brother fighting for fishing rights on the Duwamish River, and he couldn't fish no more because he was being cited by the Washington State fisheries for the right to fish in the Duwamish River. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And never be embarrassed or ashamed over some tears. In my church, there's a prayer for the gift of tears. Now, I know in today's testimony we'll find some disagreement among the various tribes, and this committee will try to sort all those out. The bottom line is we're trying to seek justice for everyone, but I do understand there are some disagreements among yourself, but all of you, I want you to speak what you truly believe, and this committee will try to sort things out. And I again appreciate your presence here today, and I will ask the Honorable Ray Gardner, Chairman of the Chinook Nation. Mr. Gardner.
Thank you for the honor of being here today. I would like to start out with a proper introduction of myself. My name is Ray Gardner. I am the son of Lois Robinson, who is the daughter of Dora D. Clark, who is the daughter of Annie Hawks, who is the daughter of Nellie Cecina and Tom Hawks, and Tom was the son of John Hawks, whose proper given name, before changed by the missionaries, was Huxvelt. Huxvelt was one of the signature signers of the 1851 Tansy Point Treaty. Some of the treaties that have been discussed here today as to why they were or were not ratified. I think that just in that alone answers one of the questions of, have we continued to stay in our land? My family has never left. We have been there since time immemorial. We have been there since a signature signer, a full chief of a treaty. In being the elected chairman of the five tribes of the Chinook Nation is what allows me the honor to be here today and present this testimony. Some of the things I'd kind of like to touch on just briefly is from the questions that I heard earlier. One of the things that was talked about was, have we had lapses in time of being there? As I stated from my own lineage, I think we can show that we have constantly been in that area and we have not left. The BIA agencies within themselves, from the time of the Tansy Point Treaties in 1851 through 1955, through various offices of their own, have stayed in contact with the Chinook people. My grandmother, my great aunties, my great uncles were all removed from their homes and put in tribal schools, again, because they were from a recognized tribe. Through the different land allotment acts, the Chinook people were given land allotments as a recognized tribe. One of the things that has concerned me as time has gone on and talking about the continuation of government, and just in myself, this is my second term as the chairman of the Chinook Nation. Prior to that, I was elected to the position of vice chair. Prior to that, I was elected to general counsel. We have always had a very strong and ongoing government that meets at least once a month to carry on the business of our people and to work with outside agencies. We have a very strong and continuing dialogue with agencies within the local cities, the county, and the state. One example of that is from on our timeline in 1805-06, we were the tribe at the mouth of the Columbia River that met Lewis and Clark when they got there. we were the ones that helped them survive that terrible winter that they describe in their own journals. During that time, it was very important, I think, that one, we really pointed out the fact that we were there and that we have stayed. But because of that commemoration, there was a national park that was going to be built on the Lower Columbia River. During the time of the building of that park, 9 of our ancestors were uncovered by a backhoe. We have, from that day forward, been in constant contact, at least quarterly, meeting with the heads of 8 different state agencies working through the issues, as well as federal agencies, on how do we move forward with that national park. We've had very strong support, as shown in the attachments to the testimony from the governor's office, showing those ongoing negotiations, and also the University of Washington. One of the things I would also like to touch on briefly is talking about continuing of time on land. We have an elder here with us today, Phil Hawks, who was the last Chinook that was born on Goose Point. Goose Point was one of the locations that during the treaty negotiations, the people were told they had to move to. Some of the families did move there. Philip was born there and only spoke Chinook until he went to kindergarten. Phil still resides right next to Goose Point and walks there daily. We have another elder, Sammy Pickernail, who's not here today. But he was actually removed from Long Island by the federal marshals when the federal marshals came out and said that they were going to make it into a wildlife preserve, and in such that the family had to leave. We also have families that have been at and are still at Pillar Rock on the Columbia River. So I think we have shown our time of being there. One of the things I would just like to briefly mention is the frustration on our part of being recognized and then having that recognition taken away. But in the same respect, I think it needs mention that our tribes were actually terminated in the Oregon Termination Act of 1954. And where they were terminated by an act of Congress, it actually does take Congress to restore those tribes. So I would really appreciate everyone going over the rest of the testimony. Obviously, I don't have time to go over it all. I really appreciate the honor of being here and speaking on behalf of our people, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Curtis B. Chambers, the tribal chairman of the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa.
Good afternoon, Congressman Kilby. My name is Curtis Chambers, and I'm very proud to be the tribal chairman for the Burt Lake Sheboygan Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Thank you for holding this hearing today. I'd also like to thank our tribe's firekeepers for attending a ceremonial fire in honor of these proceedings as we speak. I'd also like to thank yourself, Congressman Kildee, Congressman Stupak, for sponsoring our bill, H.R. 1358, and for your long and continued support of our tribe. I'd also like to thank Chairman Rahal and former Chairman Don Young for their support. While my written presentation will go into some detail, I would like to, in my oral presentation, highlight 3 main areas. First will be a brief history of our tribe. Second, an overview of our tribe's interaction with the BIA and the OFA. Third will be a legislative historical account that will bring us up to date. First, our tribe has resided on the northwest shore of Burt Lake since time immemorial, and some of us still do. Our village was burned to the ground in 1900 by a local lumber baron, and to this day, we still take care of the original cemetery located there, as well as our own church and the current cemetery on Indian Road. Every member of our tribe can document their lineage to Indian Point to Indian Road from our original village or on Indian Road from 1911 when the U.S. brought its case against the aforementioned lumber baron, a case that was unfortunately lost in 1917. We take care of each other as brothers and sisters. We respect and honor our elders and assist in protecting our children when a family crisis arises. We practice traditional ways of hunting and gathering, Our artisans produce porcupine quill work, beadwork, and woodwork, just to name a few. And the how-to CDs are sold right here in Washington, D.C. at the American Indian Museum. And we participate in Native supports. These are all possible because we've never stopped being a tribe, and we never will. We have a long history of problems in dealing with the BIA as well as the OFA. Despite our past government-to-government relations, and the BIA cannot explain fully why we're left off the list of federally recognized tribes, and they have ceased to provide services for our people. And this process is not new to us. My own great-grandfather, Albert Chinonequit, petitioned the BIA in the 1920s to advocate for return of our land base. As you know, all 10 of those landless tribes in Michigan were left off the list of federally recognized tribes that was produced in the late 1970s. And now all have had their status reaffirmed except Burt Lake and Grand River. The BIA focused their attention on the three tribes they reorganized and ignored the rest of us. Recognition under the Indian Rights Act is clearly not required for maintaining federal status. Many tribes, such as the Navajo, the Crow, and the Yankton Sioux, did not reorganize, but are still recognized by the United States government. We started our bid for the U.S. to reaffirm our status in the late 1970s. As we were a tribe with little money and few political connections, we watched as other tribes went ahead of us. We finally had legislation and wrote to the White House to get someone to address our plight and to advocate to the OFA that they would read our petition. After 25 years, the OFA finally read our petition in 2000. This was a full 100 years after our tribe had become landless because of the burnout. Our petition included thousands of papers, hundreds of pictures, and dozens of testimonials. And when the OFA returned a negative decision, we were shocked, as well as the other surrounding tribes. Noted Indian scholars like your former chief of staff, Franklin Ducheneau, and the Senate's former chief counsel, Peter Taylor, called it the most outrageous decision they had seen in 30 years. Then the OFA went on to say that while regulations prevented them from recognizing us, that Congress might be able to help. And that's why I'm here today. To say that we are angry and frustrated is an understatement. And now, legislatively speaking, the Burt Lake Band has twice signed treaties with the United States government, one in 1836 and another in 1855. Both were ratified by the Senate. And then again in the 1920s, my old great-grandfather appeared before Congress again, advocating the return of some of our treaty funds. My great-grandpa was a pretty busy man. We have a government-to-government relationship with the United States Congress. Excuse me, with the United States, and Congress has never taken action to terminate that relationship. Our current bill, H.R. 1358, simply corrects years of neglect by the United States government to fulfill their treaty promises. We are asking again for this commission's support, as we had it before in 1994, 1995, 1997, and again in 2007. In closing, I want to thank you for agreeing to hold this hearing and sincerely ask that the United States government do the right thing by passing this bill to reaffirm the government-to-government relationship that has never been terminated. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, Chairman Chambers. Our next witness is Mr. John Sinclair, president of the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians of Montana.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to thank Chairman Ray Hall, Congressman Hastings, and our good friend Congressman Rayburg for arranging this hearing. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of H.R. 3120, a bill to recognize the Little Shell Tribe of Montana. My name is John Sinclair, and I speak today as president of the Little Shell Tribe, a position held before me by my father and grandfather. Like my father and grandfather, I lead the tribe's effort to finally obtain federal recognition, a generations-long effort by my people. I have a written statement in support of H.R. 3120 that I ask be included in the record.
Without objection, the entire statement will be included.
Thank you. I will summarize the main points of that statement. First and most important, there is no serious question that the Little Shell people are an Indian tribe. Our ancestors negotiated treaties with the United States, treaties by which we lost all of our ancestral lands. In fact, our leaders walked away from a treaty that called for our removal from our ancestral territory, even though our ancestors lost title to their land and ancestors stayed in our territory and followed our traditional way of life as long as possible. By the 20th century, our traditional way of life was no longer possible, and our people became poor and homeless. We were known as the landless or trash can Indians. The United States always knew who we were, though, and always acknowledged the United States' obligations to our people. After the passage of the Indian Organization Act, the United States repeatedly promised a new land base for our people, a land base that provide the basis for renewing our people and for recognition of the tribe. The last 150 years of dealings between our people and the United States show the continuous existence of a separate and very determined Indian people. As you know, we are and have been in the administrative federal acknowledgement process for more than 30 years. In 2000, BIA issued its proposed finding on the tribe's petition and proposed that the tribe be recognized. BIA recommended that the tribe submit additional evidence on some issues, and the tribe has done so. While we took the time and effort to submit that information, since BIA issued its preliminary favorable finding in 2000, no one, not the state of Montana, local governments, or other tribes in the state, has submitted any substantial evidence to dispute BIA's 2000 proposed finding to recognize the tribe. In fact, the state and local counties and other tribes in Montana have all supported the tribe's recognition. We must underscore that H.R. 3120 accomplishes things that cannot be done through the administrative process. It establishes a four-county service area for the tribe, and it directs the secretary to acquire 200 acres of trust land in the service area for the tribe, a process that can in itself take years, even after a tribe is recognized in the administrative process. The bill also resolves the uncertainty created by the Supreme Court's recent decision in Carcieri versus Salazar. It does this by making plain that the Secretary of the Interior has the authority to take land into trust for the tribe. I can't imagine a more hollow victory for the Little Shell Tribe than to complete the decades-long administrative process, only to be told in the end that the Secretary cannot provide a land base for the tribe because of the Carcieri decision. That is why the tribe urges Congress to act on the tribe's behalf, regardless of how or when. The administrative process comes to an end. Without congressional action, the tribe will be forced to wait many more years before it obtains a service area and a land base. Indeed, because of the uncertainty created by the Carcieri case, without congressional action, the tribe may never receive a land base at all. Instead, the tribe believes it should immediately be recognized and all related issues addressed at the same time. Define a service area, clarify the secretary's authority to place land into trust for the tribe, and mandate that the secretary place 200 acres into trust for the tribe. These provisions all appear in the Congressman Rayburg's bill. It is my hope that this is the year, after all these years of waiting, that the United States will acknowledge the Little Shell Tribe's continued existence. On behalf of the Little Shell people, I urge the committee to act favorably and quickly on Congressman Rayburg's bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're now here from Fawn Sharp, President of the Quinault Indian Nation, Tehola, Washington. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the Quinault Indian Nation, we appreciate and are truly honored with the privilege of appearing before this committee to offer testimony on a very important piece of legislation, the Chinook Nation Restoration Act. My name is Fawn Sharp. I'm president of the Quinault Business Committee, the elected governing body for the Quinault Indian Nation. I have submitted a written testimony. Before I get into some of the specifics with regard to the legislative provisions that we would like to speak to, I do want to answer some of the questions that were raised from the earlier discussion this morning. And I want to couch my remarks in this context. First of all, the Quinault Nation does not challenge the authority of Congress, who has plenary power to enter into political relationships with any group of tribes or Indians. That's a fundamental principle. Secondly, we do not we have a great deal of respect for the effort of the Chinook people. It's been a longstanding battle, and we do not challenge the right of any group of Indian people to seek having a political relationship with the United States or Congress. The issue that I would like to raise with the committee and couch our remarks is that there is another fundamental principle that the United States has unique relationships with Indian tribes. And it's not a relationship with tribes as a collective group. As you well know, Mr. Kildee, your extensive experience in Indian affairs. The relationship that the United States has is with each tribe in their unique position. There are 500-plus relationships that the United States has. They're singular. They're unique. They're deeply rooted in cultural and historic values that vary quite dramatically and widely. And our remarks emanate from that concept that the Quinault people have a unique relationship with the United States, and we have rights, privileges that emanate from that relationship that are secured by the treaty. And so as we proceed with our remarks, I want to just lay that as a framework for our discussion. I want to speak to the issues that were raised with regard to criteria. When I first learned of a proposed bill, that was my first question. Within Interior, there are the criteria that are established. They're clearly laid out. And the issues that Quinault had weren't necessarily entirely with a great deal of animosity. It was fundamental principle of the branch of acknowledgement and recognition, their review of the criteria that were listed. Now, there's a longstanding relationship between the two that goes back 100 years. And I, as the leader of the Quinault Nation, I want to improve that relationship, but improve it in a way where our respective bodies are mutually respected, where the relationship with the United States has integrity. With regard to the issues that Quinault raised during the IBIA proceedings and the proceedings within the administrative branch, there were three different provisions that we challenged. Now, when we at Quinault make public policy, we look at financial implications, we look at scientific technical implications, we look at the legal implications, and from my personal perspective, that's just a matter of good public policy. You give professional deference, you give financial deference. And in this particular issue, what we saw coming forward was a situation where in the Bureau, the branch of acknowledgement and recognition, highly trained scientists arrived at a conclusion, and that conclusion was brought forward. And from our perspective, there should have been given deference, professional and scientific deference, to those conclusions. Ultimately, what happened was those that were in policymaking positions, those that were in politically appointed positions, chose to ignore the science that underlied the previous decisions. Now, it was political in that, you can use the word political as cliche, but it was political in that those that made the decisions were political appointments. And when we proceed at Quinault internally, we ensure that our tribal council, when they're acting as individual councilmen, that they respect the professional deference of our scientists. Our tribal elected officials are not doctors, they're not foresters, they're not scientists, but you allow the public process to proceed where those issues of scientific integrity are allowed to go forward. And so a lot of the questions that we raised weren't so much adversity to the Chinooks being recognized as much as it was integrity in the process. And I would expect that tribes that are seeking recognition, once they do become recognized, they will press the United States Congress, they will press the Department of Interior. If they are acting outside of the rules, we want to ensure that rules are predictable and that they do have integrity. So those are the primary bases. There were also decisions that came out of the Court of Claims. There were decisions that came out of three previous statutes. And again, there wasn't given legal deference or scientific deference. With regard to, I'd like to answer, I'm glad Congressman Inslee stepped back into the room. I'd like to speak to the issue of the treaty rights. I believe we probably share the same issues as the Suquamish raised in their letter. And you could tell from the statement, the response from the previous panel in the discussions about the treaty reserved rights, that there is a misunderstanding among members of Congress. There was a statement made that Judge Bolt granted these rights to tribes. It's well-established law that treaty rights are reserved. they're a reservation of rights not granted. So neither the Congress nor the courts nor any other entity can grant to Indian tribes rights. We've reserved those from time immemorial, and those are based in the treaty. President Reagan, in visiting Russia, made a statement that U.S. gave to Indian tribes territories and lands. So that is a misconception that somehow Congress, the courts, political bodies can grant these rights to Indian people. We've reserved them. I've taken people to the Quinault Reservation, lands that we've held in trust, and lifted up the dirt. The United States has never owned nor possessed these lands from time immemorial. And so we want to ensure that as Congress moves through these issues, the integrity of that process is recognized and protected, because Congress, the courts, no one can invade an interest that is secured by treaty, by the Constitution, to take rights to give to another. And so those are the bases for which we want to advance the Quinault Nation's interests, to ensure that as tribes move into recognition, that in no way are those things that are reserved from time immemorial, that we've had this relationship for 150 years, are compromised. I'd like to just briefly refer to those provisions in the written testimony.
We may have a vote soon on the floor, so if you can...
Sure, absolutely. 30 seconds. Thank you. The specific provisions we've outlined in Section 4, Section 7, 8, and 9, and those, I'd like the members to view those remarks in the context that I've laid out in this testimony. Thank you.